This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There are some big events that a whole lot of us get up for. Sports fans love the Super Bowl and the World Series and the World Cup. Movie fans wait for the newest sequel or big blockbuster. Most of us pay close attention to the elections. But for a political scientist, nothing this year will come even close to Brexit.
It's a step that the people have suggested that they want to take, but it's not a done deal.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a political science professor who is also an expert on European politics about the ins and the outs and the squiggles yet to come of the UK's recent vote. We'll also spend an academic minute looking for what we really want in a politician: virtue, vice, or something in between. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. So in the past couple of weeks, you've no doubt heard a lot about the United Kingdom's vote to leave the European Union. It is a fascinating story, and one that will continue to play out for months, even years. So what would someone who specializes in political science think of this whole thing? Luckily, I happen to know someone just like that. Dr. Michelle Williams is the chair of the Department of Government and a professor of political science at the University of West Florida. We sat down a few days after the vote, and, well, here was my first question. What just happened?
That is a great question. The European Union has been developing in a deeper and deeper union over the past 60, 70 years now. So since the end of World War II, the European Union started to emerge as an economic free trade zone, coal and steel commission initially, to help rebuild Europe. So it was an economic banding together of nation states. Originally starts as 12 and then now expands to current 28 minus 1, 27. And over time, the union took on more and more of a political character. So especially starting in the 1990s, toward the end of the 90s, several treaties were introduced. The Treaty of Amsterdam in 97 and then followed a few years later by the Treaty of Nice. And both of those treaties were turning points for the union because they both had a component that suggested deepening the governmental sovereignty component of the European Union. So the economic basis had been established, and the Eurozone, the common currency, came into effect 7 years before those treaties started to emerge. And then with those treaties, the next step for Europe was, what do our governments do together as opposed to what do our economies do together? And so that was a big shift for the proud nation states of Europe. It would be a big shift for any nation state because at that point, you're talking about national sovereignty and how much of the national sovereignty is given over to the European Union. And it was at that point that nation states started pushing back, some of them really thinking hard about what they wanted to get out of the European Union. Was it merely economic benefit, or did they really see themselves as becoming more of a United States of Europe over time? It's interesting because they had long had a parliament. They had long had a commission, an executive body of European leaders that come together in Brussels. So they were behaving in many ways bureaucratically like a United States of Europe prior to that time. But the treaties would have them sign off as individual nations on this idea of a common Europe, a common European purpose. And suddenly it had much more to do with national sovereignty and national identity. And I think that's the beginning of when nation states started to ask themselves if this is really what they signed on for. And an interesting thing, or maybe the most interesting thing to me, is you start to see in 2007, 2008, the time of the Lisbon Treaty, you start to see national referenda in prominent European Union member states where the people surprised their governments and said, we are not happy with the direction of deepening the sovereignty of the European Union, potentially at a higher level above national sovereignty. So there was an outcry. France was one of the first in 2005. The Netherlands followed suit, where in France it was 55% approximately, and in the Netherlands just over 60% of the people in the referendum that said, no, we would not want to see the European Union become more sovereign. Take on increasing sovereignty, I guess would be the way to put it.
France didn't want to become Michigan.
Right. Okay. That's exactly right. And France had been, in their own minds especially, the leaders of European unity. So back to Jean Monnet at the time of the founding of the European Union, French diplomats, French leaders had pressed the concept of European unity after World War II as if it was their own special idea. And they're very proud of the role that they've played in building the European Union. So for the people of France to come out and vote, even though it's a narrow majority, to vote against the idea of deepening European Union, it shocked the bureaucrats of France at the time. And they quickly went into panic and cover mode to try to figure this out. But they were truly surprised that their people were not as proud as they were of this mission of the European Union.
But they didn't vote to leave the Union. They just voted to not strengthen it anymore.
Right, right. They voted to not strengthen it. And that's where we were, what is that, almost 10 years ago now, was countries considering whether or not deeper unity was something that they were interested in, strengthening the authority that's given to the European Union to make certain decisions in common. And a lot of the press for that started with the Schengen agreements around the turn of the 21st century with immigration. And so the European Union had long had an economic common policy, included agriculture and trade. But to start talking about things like the transit of people, at the time it had to do with East European workers having the ability to freely work. As those nation states joined the European Union, having the ability to freely work in European Union member states and get work permits without having to apply as a foreign national. And so as this started to become more commonplace and there was a transit of a, at the time, lower wage labor coming from the East, the European Union had to talk about the transit of persons, how they're going to handle migration within the Union, and how they're going to handle asylum seekers and migration external to the Union. And that really gave rise to a lot of nationalist backlash, a lot of nationalist sentiment. And so parties like the UKIP party of Boris Johnson's affinity, he's not a UKIP member, but he has much in common with the UKIP in terms of the current Leave the EU campaign. That's their most fundamental principle. Those parties, those people who supported those initiatives drew a lot of inspiration from the furor surrounding a nationalist backlash when it came to talking about immigration and how that was going to affect the composition, identity, character of the nation states of the Union.
How much does the migrant crisis have to do with this?
I think this is a populist moment. I really do. And when I say that, populism today means an anti-immigrant platform. And so I mentioned the UKIP party, and it is the far-right anti-immigrant party of the United Kingdom. And it is also the voice of the Exit Leave campaign. When it comes to a political party that says, first and foremost, out of the European Union. And I think that is driven almost entirely by an anti-immigrant platform, which raises identity questions, national sovereignty questions. But really, I think that is a strong impetus behind all of what we're seeing on the far right.
Had the UK completely embraced the European Union? I mean, they kept their own currency.
That's right. And that's a really strong signal for one of the larger nation states of the Union. So the UK had been an integral player from the very beginning after World War II, but they had never been completely on board with the concept or the direction of European unity, not like a France or a Germany who have been all in for the most part from the beginning. The UK had had some reservation. Geographically, they could make the claim, we're an island, we're sort of hovering off the coast, we're not part of the actual continent. But it was much more than that, I think. There's a long, proud history of UK, England first sentiment among the people of the UK. And so you're absolutely right. The UK held off completely on economic unity. They did not adopt the euro as their currency. They kept the British pound. And things like currency and language are remarkably important to nation states and national identity. They're often underestimated. So to say we cannot give up our currency and become a part of this union was a profound statement on the part of the UK. So They accept the treaties that they want to accept. There are certain aspects of membership that they're required to sign off on as members. That would include paying a percentage of the dues to the European Union that all member states pay, accepting the trade policies. But they were able to opt out, because states were given that option, of the euro currency. And they did.
How surprising was this? Did anyone expect this to actually happen?
I have to say, for me, this was like the Scottish nationalist vote. I thought it would be close, but I thought at the end of the day, cool heads would prevail, because this is truly a big move. That said, it's a step that the people have suggested that they want to take, but it's not a done deal. There is a lot that would have to follow politically to facilitate a transition like this. So the people have spoken, and the people have said, we want independence. We want our nation state sovereignty. We don't want to be subject to any rules of the union. And that seems to be the message that's come from this vote. But at the same time, it is a long road, and the leadership of the United Kingdom are the ones that will have to adopt the measures, parliamentary measures, to initiate the process of breaking the treaty agreements that have been put into place.
You said the people have spoken. Can the people be ignored?
That's a question. And as political scientists, we love the fact that we can never predict people's behavior, even with our best survey instruments and our statistical tools. We're always shocked from time to time. And this is one of those moments where we're shocked. So the people have spoken, and we're talking about the scenarios that might play out in political science. One of the possible scenarios that I've heard would be that for this to actually transpire, for the follow-through to happen, it would perhaps require going back to a reseating of a new parliament. In other words, calling for an election. That could either legitimize the Leave camp, or it could go the other way, and it could allow people to change their minds, and it could install a Remain group sitting in parliament. But basically, now that the people have spoken, it's up to the leaders sitting in parliament to take a vote. And they have to decide whether or not to represent the best interest or the direction of their party leadership, which in this case, the majority party was David Cameron and the Conservatives. So do we stay with the Remain group, which is normally what parliament and members of parliament would do? Or is this a populist moment where the people have spoken and we go back to our constituencies and we talk to people and we listen to people and we possibly break camp with the party? And that's the big question. One of the things that could happen is the members of parliament could let the people speak again, which sort of gets them off the hook. And the way that that would happen, they're not due for elections until 2020. But in their system, two-thirds of the members sitting can call for elections anytime within the current term. And so they could call for that vote. Do we want to have early elections? And if it passes by two-thirds, then they would give the voice back to the people and say, is this really what you wanted?
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Michelle Williams continues with a look at what happens when elections in the UK are called for. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Michelle Williams, the chair of the Department of Government and a professor of political science at the University of West Florida. We're talking about the Brexit vote and not only what it means to Europe, but also what it means for people who study political science. Dr. Williams talked about the possibility of elections and seating a new parliament in the UK.
So the elections happen quickly. Not a lot of time for campaigning, a few weeks to get it organized, probably no more than a month would transpire. The election would take place and a new group would be seated in parliament, potentially, or maybe the same group, depending on the outcome. So if they call elections under that circumstance, you would see people who are running for office campaign on either the Remain or the Leave camp. They probably would have a lot of conversations within the parties. They only have two main parties, and so the Conservative Party, Labour Party would have some conversations with the fragmented wings of their parties and see if they could get on the same page again. And the parties are the ones that choose the candidates that they run for office from the party. So what that would mean is within the parties, if the conversation goes so that the mainstream wing of the party wins out, you would see mostly mainstream candidates running for office. But their gamble has to be the UKIP party or the third party factor. So the Liberal Democrats were the big surprise, forcing a coalition government in partnership with the Conservatives back in 2010. And the UK really doesn't have a tradition of three parties. It's like the US. It's had two parties alternating in power over its post-war 20th century history. And so that was sort of a landmark moment in the UK. And this could be another where, rather than the Liberal Democrats, you could see the UKIP party, which is the independence party of the far right. You could see that party, which got 13% of the popular vote in the last election, really making a play for we are the new third party.
And we're recording this the end of June, and Boris Johnson just announced he's not running for prime minister. He's not the guy.
That was some surprising news to me this morning. He's the figurehead, front runner, spokesperson for the Leave campaign. He's been the outspoken spokesperson. And it certainly seemed like he was poised to position himself to be the next prime minister. However, that signals to me that he's spent some time in consultation with the party over the last couple of days. And I believe the party has probably told him in no uncertain terms, you are not prime minister material. He has been the renegade, maverick, mayor of London, but he has not held national political office. And so the people that they're looking at this morning and talking about as the potential next prime ministers to step in and fill the gap left by David Cameron in the short term are people that have national level cabinet ministerial experience, and Johnson just doesn't display that resume.
So who is on the continent now saying, this is our chance? Who profits from this?
Who profits is a great question. I wonder if the nation states have taken a time to breathe and shift gears and think about their own advantage at this point. I think everyone is still in shock as I look to what people are saying across the continent. I am intrigued by the fact that France has been more silent than I would have expected. I don't see them out in front of the media making a lot of bold statements about next steps and big directions. And this is interesting to me because France is historically playing a role of leader of the European Union. So from the time of Jean Monnet post-World War II up to the present time, France considers itself the de facto leader of the Union. And French and English are the two functional languages of the European Union, which is an aside, but it raises another question for me, which is if someone else steps forward and the UK is out, is English still one of the functional languages or the de facto language of the Union? Perhaps it becomes French and German. I certainly see Germany talking a lot about the implications and about the road ahead. Angela Merkel has been in front of the press and in the news from the very beginning, talking about calm after the storm, talking about the fact that the union does not have a direct implication from the decision of the UK. And she's talked about the need for everyone to slow down a bit because this is far from over. Her suggestion all along has been one that would imply that this is not something that is already finished, that perhaps there's a pathway and a process that she would support for changing this outcome from the direction in which it currently appears to be heading. But certainly she seems to be stepping forward as the voice of the union at the present time, in my opinion. And that's not surprising, given the fact that Germany has been the economic center of the European Union throughout most of its history as a union. And certainly since the common currency came into effect, it's the central bank of the union in Germany that is the storehouse for the currency backing of the euro. And the economic role that Germany has played, I think, positions it well to be in a leading role of the union today. Most of the upheavals of the European Union of the last 5 to 10 years have had much to do with economics, countries defaulting, the Greek crisis, and some of the others that came along about that same time. And so this put Germany in a position of often having to speak on behalf of the European Union about what austerity measures meant and about what pathways were next for keeping the resolve and keeping the integrity of the union. And so I think Germany fits this role quite comfortably right now, but we'll have to see.
Dr. Michelle Williams is the chair of the Department of Government and a professor of political science at the University of West Florida in Pensacola. And I've got her on speed dial if we need to update what's going on in a few weeks. What exactly makes a politician influential? The good, the bad, the not quite so sure? Do we like them naughty or nice? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do virtues or vices make for a more influential politician? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Leanne Ten Brink, Banting postdoctoral fellow in the Haas School of Business and Department of Psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, describes how these different factors affect the political elite.
What qualities make a political leader more or less influential? Philosophers, political scientists, and psychologists alike have puzzled over this question and have proposed two very different routes to political power. The first traces back to Aristotle, who reasoned that a politician should, above all, be virtuous. He believed that political influence was to be found in virtuous practices such as temperance, courage, and humility. Machiavelli offered a much different approach. He advised political leaders to exert influence by force, manipulation, and violence if necessary. We coded the behavior of 151 U.S. senators in political speeches for indicators of virtues and vices, and examined whether this index of their leadership style predicted their level of collaborative influence over others. For example, senators who spoke with a loud, steady voice and narrowed their eyes in determination were given high ratings on courage. And senators who expressed excessive pride and spoke primarily about themselves were given high ratings on narcissism. We found that virtuous senators became more influential when they moved into a leadership role, specifically a committee chair role. In our data, expressing empathy for others, being concerned with justice and fairness, and communicating courage increased senators' ability to gain co-sponsors on their bills when they became committee chairs. In contrast, senators displaying behaviors consistent with vices, particularly psychopathy, became less influential when they moved into leadership roles. Results suggest that when casting a vote, citizens should consider a candidate's virtue. Voting for a virtuous candidate may increase the likelihood that elected officials will have genuine concern for their constituents, while simultaneously promoting cooperation and progress in government.
That was Leanne Ten Brink of the University of California, Berkeley. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.